Welcome back to another episode of The Rules of Investing, a podcast that gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists, and industry experts, brought to you by Livewire Markets. I'm Ali Selby, and in the last episode, James Marlay sat down with 1851 Capital's star stock picker, Chris Stott, to learn where he's seeing value in the small cap market right now. This week, we're going global. Wilson Asset Management's Katrina Burns has been living in New York for a few years now and has been busy meeting with management teams and uncovering opportunities under Australians' radars. Today, we'll be learning what it's actually like on the ground, how the WAM Global team identify opportunities, as well as some of Katrina's favourite stocks. If you're an Apple Podcast or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a Livewire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of the wire to be notified when new episodes are available. Not a Livewire subscriber yet? Just head on over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free, easy to register, and you'll get access to insights from leading investment minds in the country. Okay, let's get on with the show. Thanks so much for joining us on The Rules of Investing today. Really excited to have you here in Sydney after so much time between interviews.
Thanks for having me, Ali.
Let's start with the big picture. You've obviously been living in the US for a few years now. With interest rate cuts now being pushed out into the future, what's it actually like on the ground?
Yes, so living in New York, it is you can certainly notice the inflation that's come through in the last few years in terms of the cost of living pressures. But generally, the economy has been really resilient. And that's because of those pandemic savings that people had coming out of COVID. It's been from the very strong, you know, fiscal spending from the government. And because there, you know, has been finally some catch up in terms of wage growth. So, you know, living in New York, it's certainly a gritty city, and you do see at the lower end some inflationary pressures on the lower end consumer. But generally, the economy in the US has been remarkably resilient.
Has it changed at all your outlook on inflation and rates in recent months?
So, I mean, we tend to be bottom-up stock pickers, but you can't avoid, you know, a debate and conversation around rates and inflation, particularly in the last few years. Certainly coming into this year, we were pretty vocal, even externally, about the fact that 6 rate cuts being priced into the market looked to us too many. Sitting here today, you know, you're closer to that, you know, 1 cut, which, you know, for us, seeing, you know, how the economy is actually holding up seems, you know, reasonable. And so, you know, but what will be, we'll have to watch for is just the data that continues to come through. So those, you know, you've heard Powell say in recent meetings, they're very much watching those inflation statistics and that sticky inflation around the 3% level, when their target's 2, you know, is the key watch point. So for us, those 6 rate cuts, you know, seemed, you know, that was too much given the resilience we saw in the underlying economy. But we're more balanced now in terms of, you know, where we are with expectations.
As I mentioned in the intro, you're out there meeting with all these management teams that we wouldn't be able to speak with here in Australia. How does the WAM Global team actually identify opportunities? And is there one non-negotiable when it comes to a stock actually making its way into your portfolio?
Yep, so absolutely, in terms of a key part of our process is meeting the management teams of the companies we're investing and then meeting the competitors, the suppliers, talking to employees, talking to industry experts. You know, we see over 700 companies a year all around the world, whether that's in Europe, Japan, the US. So we're constantly having those conversations with management teams.
I feel like it's important to note that you have quite a small team too.
There's 17 of us across the whole investment, you know, professionals across the business, but yeah, 4 direct on this fund. Yes, so we're constantly on the road meeting management teams. And so in terms of non-negotiables, I mean, honesty and trust in the management team for us is paramount, and that's why, you know, over time, you know, you're consistently meeting these management teams, you're investing and then meeting them and then looking again at what they're doing. Have they hit their targets? Have they done what they said? And so if we have any doubts around, you know, that trust factor and that they will deliver on what they say, then it's just non-negotiable. And, you know, there can be red flags, like, are they selling stock? Do they do, you know, value destructive deals, etc.? And, you know, often whether a management team is in the same company for a long time or moves to another, you know, you can watch their track record over time. You talk to them, you see if they're actually delivering what you say. And if you have any doubts on that trust factor, for us, that's completely non-negotiable that we won't invest.
Mm. Are there any other factors that are important for a stock to make its way into your portfolio?
Yes, definitely. So in terms of our process, it's really first, you know, our first point of call is looking at the industry structure of a business that we're investing in. And, you know, what is a company's industry position? How many competitors are there? Are there low barriers to entry so that their competitive position is being diluted over time? You know, these are all there's businesses that we rule out. So working out where a company is in the industry that they operate in. And because strong industry position leads to things like pricing power, etc., which is been obviously paramount in an inflationary environment. Mm. But just even strong industry position is crucial even in bad times, you know, in recessions, etc., because these are the companies that win share when times are tough as well. So identifying businesses that we think will do that over time is paramount. Then that management piece in terms of ability to execute, trust in the management team, track record of delivering, and alignment. So, you know, those incentives, you know, incentives drive outcomes. And so often, whether it's, you know, that the incentives were wrong and that they led to bad behaviour, you know, I can't tell you how many times, say, you have incentives for management based around earnings per share growth. So companies just chase acquisitions to meet earnings growth without thinking about the returns that that are being generated on the dollars spent. So, I mean, that happens time and time again, and is a massive red flag. So, yeah, industry position, management team, then earnings growth potential of the business. So that ability to consistently grow earnings over time, and I guess our visibility and ability to forecast that earnings growth.
Is there a CAGR that you target for all the portfolio companies?
Yeah, double digit earnings growth is kind of, yeah. And if a company's below that, it's it has to be generally coming back up to that. Like they've had a short term, you know, we've had some companies where there was post pandemic, you know, unwind of inventories or so forth, so that it's meant that their earnings, you know, became slower for a year or two, but that can be an opportunity because we think they are double digit compounders over time. So earnings growth potential, and then overlaid with valuation. So we don't just buy a company at any price. We have very, you know, strict valuation discipline based on what we think the earnings growth, like coupling earnings growth with valuation, and then a catalyst that we think will drive the share price higher.
You talked about alignment before. There's obviously some of the most famous founders in the world on the global scale.
Yep.
Are you looking for founder-led businesses or, you know, management teams that have a large amount or percentage of their wealth invested in the business that they're leading? Is that something that you look out for?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got various businesses in the portfolio where that's the case. And we love founder-led businesses where the alignment is very strong. And, I mean, there's an example of a German company, CTS Aventum, where the founder owns over 30% of the stock. So it's the ticker tech equivalent of Germany, Italy, Switzerland and Austria. You know, in that, and it's got a net cash balance sheet, and a net cash balance sheet can be very dangerous for a management team, you know, that isn't, that aren't, you know, very good stewards of capital, because it can be tempting to go and burn that cash on value destructive deals. But when you have a founder-led business coupled with a net cash balance sheet, you know, we think that's amazing setup, because they're not going to destroy the value of their, you know, their own investment. And they're very well aligned with you. So, you know, in that example, we think we've got a very high quality management team with the opportunity to do some interesting things with that cash if they find the right opportunity, but absolutely will not, you know, use that in a way that would be value destructive for their own shareholding and ours.
Okay. I recently attended the Sydney Shareholder Day for Wilson Asset Management. And you and all your colleagues are super bullish on the outlook for artificial intelligence. Don't know if that is worrying or exciting. All that the same
as is here. The rest of the world.
Yeah. Ooh, The majority of your investments in this area, though, seem to be outside of the well-known names in the AI race. Why is that?
Yep. So, I mean, we own Google, for example, which we thought was oversold on the threat that AI, that they were behind in AI and so forth. And we think, you know, the valuation versus the earnings growth, you know, the setup looked exciting. We have owned Microsoft in the past, but just on valuation grounds, we don't right now. So we do, we can own and will own, you know, the more headline winners of AI. But what we think has been really interesting is to own a whole bunch of businesses that weren't necessarily your first port of call in terms of AI winners, but which are massive beneficiaries. And we've got a ton of those. So, and we kind of bucket them into a few different areas that we can see massive benefits coming from AI. And that might be in, say, we've owned SAP in Germany, for example. That's ERP software. It's basically been a duopoly between them and Oracle, but they've massively outcompeted Oracle. They're transitioning their entire client base to the cloud. A major proportion of their client base onto the cloud, which you can't, you know, utilize AI software properly without being on the cloud. Mm-hmm. And so we think they've just got a multi-decade, earnings growth, strong earnings growth potential because of that first transition to the cloud, and then they're integrating AI tools into their product set, and they have amazing data. So we, another play on AI that we have in the portfolio, which isn't, you know, necessarily your first thought, is we own Quanta Services in the US, which upgrades the power and transmission grids across the US. And they've been a massive beneficiary of energy transition and now a massive beneficiary of AI in terms of the crazy amount of investment being done in data centers. So it's interesting, they're having direct conversations now with the big tech companies, and it's not, but historically it's been, where do we want to put a data center? We'll just pick and choose. Now it's, where's the power? Because we will put our data center wherever the power is. And so these guys are the biggest player in the US at what they do, and they upgrade and maintain the grid and connect all the renewables to it. They're, you know, setting up, because there's been enormous, you know, electricity demand from EVs, from reshoring, and now from AI. We think it's an interesting way to play AI without being, you know, so it wasn't, you know, so loved and, you know, necessarily, you know, well covered. Right. So we think there's lots of ways like that to play AI. We also think the large language models like ChatGPT, etc., we think, you know, they'll become ubiquitous over time. And so you're seeing, you know, there's a whole lot of buzz around them right now, but the value is actually going to be in unique data. And so we own lots of businesses with incredible data sets. So whether that's like Intercontinental Exchange, CME Group, Intuit, for example, in tax, you know, and accounting software, these guys are integrating AI tools into their product set. And so you don't naturally think, oh, that's an AI, you know, winner, but we think it will be because of the unique data sets that they have, because the models are only as good as the data that goes into them. As we've all seen from putting, you know, the things they get, these models get wrong when the data isn't, you know, clean and high quality.
Mm. I own NVIDIA.
Yes.
I bought it a few years ago. Well and done. I feel like my only regret is I didn't buy more.
Yeah.
Has that hurt, not owning that, you know, major AI winner?
Definitely. Oh, it's been definitely a headwind in terms of not owning it. I guess it's been a fantastic story. The thing that's been interesting about NVIDIA and why it's probably worked so well is that the earnings forecast, like they haven't even been able to forecast, like their ability to forecast their earnings, you know, hasn't been there. And so you had a quarter where they did 11 bill when the market thought they'd do 7. And so they've just smashed forecasts because demand has been so strong. And it's interesting, even with the last round of US reporting season, the CapEx spend that the big tech companies are doing is just so incredible. Mm. I mean, our question marks are not for today. It's more once you get through, you know, this massive CapEx spend, you know, what's the earnings trajectory from there? But it's been a fantastic story.
Yeah. In your latest update, you also talked about being heavily invested in financials and healthcare right now.
Yep.
Why is that?
So the financials exposure is a little confusing from the outset because we don't actually own a bank. So it's the companies that fit into the GICS sector classification of financials is CME Group, so the exchanges.
Right.
It's Tradeweb, for example, which is digitising the fixed income space. So, yeah, CME, ICE, Tradeweb. Visa, which we own, is classified as a financial, but it's not a bank per se. So our exposures to within the financial sector are more business services, exchanges, data plays like MSCI, for example. So we own lots of businesses like that, but we don't actually own a bank. So that's the reason kind of these are kind of monopoly or duopoly businesses in most cases, wonderful compounders over time in terms of earnings growth. Often, yeah, as I said, digitizing asset classes. So we think multi-year earnings growth. And then in the healthcare space, we've got lots of investments there. We really love picks and shovels type investments where, you know, they're not picking which particular biotech trial will be successful and so forth. They're more general plays on the just enormous amount of investment in healthcare and health and well-being there is post-COVID, on demographics being your friend in terms of healthcare spend. And so, you know, we own things like Thermo Fisher Scientific, Icon, which does all the clinical trials for big and large pharma, Avantor, Gerresheimer, which is a play on winners from GLP-1 drugs. So they do the auto-injector pens that deliver the GLP-1s. So just really nice picks and shovel plays, not, you know, which particular, you know, not biotechs per se.
Why that approach in healthcare over owning the drug producers? I mean, we've seen Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk do spectacularly well.
Yep.
Why is it better to do a picks and shovels approach in healthcare?
We think it's a great way to play healthcare because, yeah, I mean, you can certainly own the the pharma companies per se, and that's not to say that we wouldn't own, like, at particular points in time, but our view is that the picks and shovels plays, it's not binary in terms of whether trials work or not. Mm. It's not, you're not making a big call on the competitive landscape. There's lots of question marks, even in the GLP-1 space, around how many players are coming into that market. And that's not directly saying that Eli and Novo Nordisk aren't great businesses. But, you just don't have to have that debate around the competitive landscape. You've got, say, in clinical trials, you've had Icon consolidate the space and really take market share, drive up margins. So you've got, you know, fragmented markets they're taking advantage of and amazing blue chip customers where they play on the growth of all the large pharma. They have all the large pharma companies as their customers, all the small pharma companies. So just you get this amazing, you know, customer base without making binary calls on which, you know, particular trials will do well or not.
WAM also loves stocks with catalysts on the horizon. Can you talk us through a stock with the biggest share price re-rating catalyst in the portfolio? A little bit of a spicy one there.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, we have all our, when we look at all our companies, we're looking for catalysts. And I mean, some of the companies I've mentioned before, we have, like, if I look through all of them, there are different catalysts that we can see, identify, and that's why we own them. So in terms of the biggest, I mean, I would say for us, it's like, it really is, you know, a combination of all different ones. So say CTS Eventum is a good example where it's the ticker tech equivalent I mentioned earlier, listed in Germany. We saw massive catalysts when we bought it in 2020 because of COVID. No one was going to ticketing. No one was going to concerts. No artists were touring, etc. Mm. And the stock had been massively sold off. Founder-led, net cash balance sheet, and analysts had slashed their forecasts. So we were like, okay, the earnings growth potential of this thing is significant. We can see multi-year catalysts. And so, I mean, that's still a stock where I think numbers are too low and I can see upside. Qantas services, which I mentioned, which is upgrading the, you know, the US transmission grid and communications infrastructure. Again, the expectations of earnings from analysts still very grounded. I can see upside there. So again, multi-catalyst. And I could do that across, like, you know, all our stocks in terms of having, you know, individual catalysts that we think will drive the share prices over time.
Why are catalysts so important?
And it's something, I mean, I started my career at WAM, but it's something we've always kind of focused on. And what I've seen over time so often is you can have cheap stocks remain cheap for a very long time without a catalyst. And so, like, the catalyst can be as much as that you really think that earnings expectations are far too low for the reality. It can be that you see an acquisition they've done has significant synergy upside that the market's not factoring, that they're going to divest businesses, that the management has changed, and you've seen them from before do an outstanding job, and you think that they'll do really well at a new company they've formed. So there's multiple catalysts that, you know, can be the thing that drives the share price. But why it's so important to us is that you can buy a stock thinking it's incredibly cheap, and it sits there cheap for the next 5 years plus. So that cheap valuations and earnings growth often, you know, over time, earnings growth drives share prices, but catalysts really set that re-rating process underway.
I think a lot of investors can relate to that, you know, buying a stock when you think it's cheap and then the share price falling further. It's definitely a disaster. I want to talk about franking credits now and dividend yields. I think it's quite unique about this portfolio. Many of your investors are really reliant on those yields and franking credits, which have continued to grow since the fund's inception. In your view, can that be sustained, particularly if global market conditions are likely to be more difficult over the coming decade, given that rates are definitely higher and inflation seems to be a lot higher too than it was over the last decade?
Yeah. So, I mean, since we started the fund in 2018, we've been building up the profit reserve, which is what we drive, what we pay dividends from. And, you know, we've built that to over 60 cents. So we've got over 5 years of dividends at the current level already banked in terms of in that profit reserve. So, and we're paying over 5% dividend yield, over 7.5% fully franked. So we have already built up that 5 years of dividends. So for us, being confident in the ability to continue to do that, we do have that confidence. The franking, we need to pay tax over time to generate the franking credits. So that's the bit that we still have to pay and do. But the dividends themselves and, you know, securing that yield that is already being paid on the fund, that's, already put in the profit reserve.
Okay. The fund is benchmarked against the MSCI World Index, but you also provide the world's mid-cap index, the small and mid-cap index as well. How should investors think about performance?
Yeah, so our benchmark is MSCI World, but we always provide the SMID index as well, because, as you know, the Wilson Asset Management, you know, founding principles, we often hunt in that small mid area, and that's like the, you know, where I started investing and where I've always, you know, loved to find ideas. And so over the life of the fund, between 55 and 70% of the fund has been invested in small mid companies and continues to be. So, I mean, the MSCI World Index is 20% Mag 7 and we have 2%. So we're always, you know, comparing, is it more relevant to look at the SMID index or the MSCI World? But we provide both so investors can make that decision. We think in terms of the small mid companies, it's really interesting in terms of, you know, over the last 6 years, they've really lagged that large cap index. And that is in part because the Mag 7 have been so strong. But it's sort of 4%, between 4 and 6% headwind each year in small mid. But we think that is really exciting in terms of the setup, because those businesses are kind of getting discarded and the momentum has been with, you know, the larger cap companies. So we think that's a really exciting hunting ground for ideas, and where we can see a lot of value because they are, yeah, if you look at the valuation disconnect, it's like 20 plus year lows for small mid versus large.
I have spoken to experts though who say, you know, it's going to be a little bit longer, more pain for small and mid caps, particularly in the US. Why do you think they're wrong?
So, I mean, you only have to look at the company. I mean, you've got to look at every individual company on its merits. And for us, it's more, to us, it doesn't matter if it's small, mid or large. It's more, does it fit our process? And do we think the earnings growth is sustainable over time? So typically small mids, the perception is that they're more cyclical in nature, so that when you're going into periods of uncertainty, they get sold off more, which is what's happened. For us, whether they're big or small, it's more about the earnings growth. And if we can pick great companies that will compound earnings double digit plus per year, that's what's going to drive the share price, rather than that small mid necessarily have an amazing run. But you do tend to see, as you come out of periods of uncertainty and out of recessions, etc., that they run harder, and when you look over time, they actually outperform large caps. So, you know, you can't say history, you know, history will repeat, but ultimately it comes down to earnings growth.
Okay, come to the final three questions of the podcast. They're a little bit of fun, and it's just a thought experiment. What is one thing you believe investors are getting wrong about today's markets?
I think it's the over extrapolation of what is, you know, the current market, and that, you know, Mag 7 will outperform for forever. So I do think that that disconnect of those small, mid versus large will, you know, correct over time if the earnings come through in that end of the market. And I think it's also the over, you know, we all get, everyone gets distracted by the noise of, you know, is it elections? Is it, are we going into recession? But in our view, you can focus too much on the short term, you know, while missing the bigger picture. And if you can pick stocks that have great longer term structural drivers that, you know, drive earnings growth over time, the noise, you know, we won't be talking, we're talking, at, you know, this year about the election. We won't care next, because whoever's in power will be in power. And you can get very caught up in the short-term noise rather than thinking about the bigger picture.
I think it's because Trump is so divisive,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. What would him getting in mean for markets, in your view?
Well, I think he's actually more of a known entity this time than last, because, I mean, last time was pretty painful in terms of the constant tweeting and the uncertainty around, you know, US-China trade relations and so forth. So I think, certainly, he's unpredictable. So you don't want to say, you know, it's not a risk to markets. But I think ultimately he's very pro-America. And I think there's a lot of companies, you know, last time he did tax cuts, yeah. Sure, he did the tariffs, but Biden's continued most of those tariffs. So it's not like if Biden got in, they're gone, and the US-China relations necessarily thaw. So we think, you know, we're not, we can't say that he's not unpredictable, but we think, you know, markets and companies are amazingly adaptable. And you've seen that with how the market and companies adapted to the tariffs. Like, there's been enormous amount of changing, you know, enormous changes in supply chains over the last few years, and big pushes to move away from reliance on China. So companies adapt. It's the same with, you know, the Russia-Ukraine war. The energy issues in Europe, sure, it's caused cost pressures on many European businesses, but they've now, you know, found alternatives for energy supply. Like, businesses adapt. Mm. So, yeah, the ability to adapt can't be underestimated. And so even with Trump, whether it's, the markets and companies will adapt, and great businesses will continue to grow.
I know it's impossible to call an election, but what are you feeling on the ground when you talk to people in the street or talk to management teams? Which way do you think it's going to go?
Well, in the last couple of weeks, it's certainly swinging a little more Trump-weighted. It was very, very even, but you never know. It was swinging, you know, in the 2016 election, it was not swinging to Trump, and he got in. So perhaps it swings right back the other way. You can't call.
Fingers crossed. Sorry, I got a little bit distracted. We'll move on to the next question of the final three questions. We want a big loss or a big win from your investment career, a story, or some sort of lesson that you could share with our audience from that experience.
Sure. I mean, there's lots of things you get wrong. and lots of things, you know, you hope that you get right over time. I mean, I can on both ends. I think on the wins, often the learning I've had is that when a stock is working and a company and a management team are executing well, don't underestimate the ability of them to keep doing that. And great managers can do wonderful things with businesses, and they tend to, even in tougher times, you know, navigate that and take share out the other side. So that's probably on the positive. On the negative, there's lots of things I've got wrong over the years. I mean, one recently was a business called Concentrix, which was a spin out from a company, Synnex, in the US. And spin outs can be wonderful because you can have this situation where, I mean, you saw it here with Recall from Brambles, with Aurora from Amcor. You've got a business within a business that's been underinvested in, unloved, and it spins out, and the new management team in there has enormous incentives to make it work. We had this investment in Concentrix on that kind of thesis. And so they do customer experience software and sort of call centres and technology implementation in the call centre space. And what I kind of didn't react quick enough to was the perception that AI was going to totally, was going to really disrupt this business. The actual reality is it's, you know, they've chugging along okay, but the earnings momentum had started to wane. And so overlay fear on AI with earnings momentum slowing, and I should have exited quicker. So you always, you know, when things are deteriorating, don't, you know,
cut your losses.
Exactly. And with winners, you know, often let them run. Because great management teams can do wonderful things.
Okay, Katrina, last question for today. Very excited for this one. If the market were to close for 5 years, which stock would you want to own and why?
I'm going to say Intercontinental Exchange, or ICE. So this is a business that has a long-term track record of digitizing various asset classes, bringing them on exchange. So they've done that across various commodities. What they're doing now is they've amalgamated a number of assets and they're digitizing the mortgage space. So we think in terms of that setup for earnings growth over the next few years, it's, you know, really solid and probably underestimated by the market. And it's run by an outstanding management team. So the CEO, Jeff Sprecher, has done an outstanding job and we would back him to do that. And then you're coupling it with a valuation that we don't think absolutely does not reflect that opportunity.
Okay, awesome. Love that idea. Thank you so much for your time today, Katrina. It was awesome to have you here in Sydney and feature you on The Rules of Investing. Thank you again.